Yeah, I mean, Steve is a professor at the University of Warwick in the Department of Sociology, and he's published an extensive amount of books and journal articles and commentaries, which I'm not really going to comment on because I'll take up much this morning. I just want to point out that, as far as I know, this is his latest book, which is intellectual, and I'll just leave it here on the desk and just have a look at it. And overall,
okay. Well, thank you very much. This is being taped by two means, at least. I don't know. Maybe there's some covert taping going on. So whatever gets said here and whatever questions you ask, it'll be here in the public record. And so if you wonder in the future, did he really say that? There'll be an account. Now, what I want to do today, I mean, the title of the talk has to do with poses the question whether this sort of fixation on complexity that is in the title of this conference and in fact exists throughout many disciplines in the arts and sciences today, whether this is anything more than what I call postmodern positivism. Okay? And I think, first of all, it's important to get a sense of what positivism is about. Can this door be closed, maybe? It's a little distracting. Okay. Now, my assumption here, and given the introduction that was just given, I'm sort of led to believe this even more so, that most of you aren't actually frontline contributors to complexity theory in its full-blown mathematical sense. Right. I think that's probably fair, too. I mean, looking at the abstracts and papers here, one can assume this. There's a sense in which, then, there is an issue for those of you who aren't actually involved in doing this research yourselves. What's the point of paying attention to it? Okay? And I think this is kind of an issue that is very closely connected in most general terms with the history of positivism as a philosophical movement. Now, positivism, I mean, this word presumably means something. Have all of you heard of positivism? Okay? The term was coined in the 19th century by Auguste Comte, who's also the person who coined the word sociology. So there's a kind of intimate connection between these two things. The idea basically is that the natural sciences can provide kind of a basis not only for the understanding of society, but for transforming the social order, and in particular to make it more rational. All right. What came about as a result of Auguste Comte's initial efforts is this idea that, in a sense, if you're looking for what the benchmark of rationality is, if you're looking for what is the cutting edge form of knowledge that, in a sense, can be used legitimately to reorganize society, then one is always looking at the natural sciences. And so the history of positivism has largely been a history of following, you might say, the trends in science, and then reappropriating them, bringing them back into the social sphere, and trying to get them in some way to both reorganize social inquiry, but also to reorganize society as well. And throughout most of the history of positivism, sort of the main kind of beacon has been Newtonian mechanics. Newtonian mechanics because, first of all, as a body of knowledge covering domain of understanding phenomena on the Earth and the planets and so forth, very stable, very successful, not only in terms of explaining things, but also in terms of, as a science itself, in terms of extending its boundaries and so forth. And so, as a sort of research program in science, it lasted for basically over 200 years at the cutting edge of physics until Einstein's revolutions in physics and quantum mechanics in the early 20th century. But even today, of course, Newtonian mechanics still is very important. It hasn't been falsified in any kind of direct way. So that's been the main source of the influence of positivism. But of course, as the 20th century has come on, there have been all sorts of new ways of challenging kind of the idea that there are deterministic laws, that all the different levels of nature are in fact governed by the same sorts of principles, that the universe at the extremes in terms of things moving very fast or being very large operates the same way as it does during the sort of forms of physical reality that we normally confront with our senses. All these things get challenged in the 20th century, and so we get a variety of other sciences, relativity theory, quantum mechanics, and some would now say there are these complexity sciences that are sort of doing something similar as well. Now, the point that I want to make here very strongly is that the positivist sensibility is one that says, hey, we got to pay attention to this to make sense of social life. We have to pay attention to these developments that in the first instance are occurring, you know, in sort of abstract physical reality separated from social space or in chemical reality or something like that. We have to somehow pay attention to those things. That's the first positivistic move, to think those things are relevant at all. Right? I mean, and indeed, those of you who are part of the social sciences broadly construed will know that certainly in the last, I would say now about 20 years, there have been a lot of calls to basically say that the social sciences have to kind of reinvent and reorganize and redo themselves in light of a lot of stuff that is associated with complexity theory. Okay? There was a famous commission that was inaugurated by Emmanuel Wallerstein, who's a historical sociologist, and published a book called Open the Social Sciences. And the idea was that the social sciences were still committed to a kind of Newtonian notion of space and a Newtonian notion of closure and so forth. They had to be more open to all these different things that can be offered by complexity theory. And this was a very influential kind of report. Now, the interesting thing is the social sciences are thought to have to take their marching orders from the natural sciences. So as the natural sciences change, as they develop, the social sciences need to change as well. Okay? And that's the key thing about positivism. In terms of the way in which, and why I would say that there's a kind of continuity there. I think this is quite important because very often when we talk about things like complexity theory and we talk about the amount of, let's say, diversity, indeterminacy that it introduces into our understanding of social phenomena, this is often talked about in the context where one is talking about being anti-positivistic. But when people say anti-positivistic in this context, they usually just mean sort of anti-Newtonian in terms of the model of physics, physical reality they're operating with. But it's still taking the marching orders from the natural science. It's just taking it from a more advanced form of natural science. Okay, so the pecking order issue remains the same. However, positivism isn't just about imitating the natural sciences. I mean, this is usually the thing that, in fact, people hate about positivism. Here are these social sciences following whatever trend happens to take place in the natural sciences. So this week it's complexity and all these social sciences now imitate complexity and talk about it and so forth. But there's other aspects of positivism that I think are worth pointing out here because, in a sense, at its best, positivism introduces some sense of what the limits might be to talking about social phenomena in these kind of naturalistic terms. And one of the limits has to do with the business of, well, why, has to do with examining why are we attracted to this stuff. The history of positivism is full of attempts to try to take scientific language and scientific formulation and put them in a form that is publicly inspectable and observable. So it has tended historically to be a very anti-jargon movement, okay? And when people talk about reductionism as part of positivism, the first thing that positivists were concerned about was the reduction of language. Right? In other words, take all this technical stuff and put it in terms that are observable and measurable and countable. And in other words, in terms that people who aren't already specialists in the area can be able to decide whether or not what you're saying is true or false or makes any difference whatsoever, or whether it's just a metaphysical guess. Now, I think this is very important when we think about complexity and the way it gets used by social sciences these days. Because looking at the sociology journals, okay, so I won't incriminate everybody here, but this just my own field, it's a lot of guess. Right? Where in a sense, right, there's a sense in which from a mathematical standpoint, what's distinctive about complexity in terms of, multiple parameters, nonlinear equations, all this kind of stuff, right, which has a very specific character to it, right, and which is the kind of thing that's used to model various kinds of physical phenomena, that aspect that makes complexity theory kind of an advance within the natural sciences, that's totally missing. And so instead what you get is metaphorical gas. Okay? I'm, of course, not accusing anyone here of this. But it does seem to me that with a lot of this natural science stuff, especially in the physical sciences, right, that what actually turns out to be the heart of what allows any kind of research to be conducted in these fields really does have to do with the mastery of these equations and their applications and so forth. You know, and that everything after that, you know, is kind of a metaphorical extrapolation. And interestingly enough, often these metaphorical extrapolations that we make in social science are ones that we already had. And this is the thing that's quite interesting. If you look at the kinds of things that social scientists tend to now valorize as, you know, our new and improving complex world, blah, 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 right? In fact, we're talking about things that we've always talked about, or at least, you know, those people who actually read, those social scientists who actually know about social science, which, you know, aren't exactly the same thing, right? Because some social scientists don't actually know all that much about social science, right? That one could find already in the social science literature. And that all that the complexity stuff does is add a certain kind of legitimatory discourse. Because we now know there are these natural scientists out there who also talk this way, right? Now, we don't use any of their mathematics. We don't use any of their modeling or simulations or anything of that sort. But we like to kind of appropriate some of their words. Okay? And this is the kind of thing, you know, that positivists would react very violently against. Because this is exactly the kind of stuff that when positivists spend a lot of their time demonizing metaphysics, this is what they were demonizing. They were demonizing this kind of metaphorical extrapolation of natural science notions without any of the things that actually make it work in the natural sciences, you know, as a possibility for a basis for a research program, but as it were appropriating sort of the significance attached to the language, the fact that it's very authoritative, that it's cutting edge. You see, and this is the thing that the positivists were worried about, this kind of illegitimate political, I mean, they saw it in very political terms, actually, because there's a sense in which, when we're talking about the natural sciences, right, they are the most prestigious forms of knowledge in our society today, not only in terms of public recognition, but also in terms of what funding streams are. So, like, if you're a social scientist and you start jabbering on about complexity, you might increase your chances of getting a research grant from our own councils. Okay? But again, does it make any cognitive difference, right? Is there any value added from a purely cognitive standpoint of actually talking about complexity? And this is the question that the positivists always keep open. It is not obvious. And this is why they made a big point of saying, look, when we say that various forms of natural scientific knowledge are valuable and important and so forth, what exactly are we referring to here? Are we just referring to the fact that people respect this stuff a lot and they sort of genuflect whenever they hear the words? Or is there something in the techniques, something in the ways in which they can understand phenomena, maybe explain it, predict it, whatever? Is that what matters? And if so, we need to actually then get it in a form, get this natural science in a form where people can actually see the legitimate grounds for respecting it. You know? And this is where the positivists would say, look, you know, a lot of this, you know, that maybe even the word complexity itself is a problem. Right, because complexity already has ordinary language meaning. Right, it already has certain kinds of associations. We already have a kind of pre-scientific understanding of what the complex is, and that can too easily just be then used, you know, in a kind of very indiscriminate way to be associated with all this more scientific stuff. Okay, and so what positivism was about trying to get this stuff clear. Now, of course, this is it's very important to get this stuff clear, because science has this kind of authority in society. And so it becomes very important that people understand at all points why are they drawing on this authority of science? On what basis are they doing this? Is there a legitimate basis for doing this? So if we say the world is becoming a more complex place, what the hell are we talking about? For example, I mean, and what does simplicity look like in this analysis? Right? If that's the opposite term. Okay, you know, in English, we have an interesting kind of semantic distinction that's worth keeping in mind at this point, and that is between the complex and the complicated. Okay, and they're not the same thing. I mean, usually when we say that something's complicated, we're saying, look, there's kind of a mess here. There's a lot of stuff we don't quite understand. It's kind of all over the place, you know, and it resists all of our normal ways of understanding things. It's kind of complicated. I can't quite figure it out. When we talk about complex, right, what we're trying to talk about, it seems to me, and I think this is where one needs to make a distinction, is that we're talking about there being a disparate array. array of phenomena, to be sure, great diversity of phenomena, but in some sense they are the products of the interaction of a certain specifiable set of variables under certain conditions. Okay? So in other words, you can kind of go back and, as it were, in principle at least, lay out the equation that generates the complexity. Okay? So there's a sense in which you can go back and you can sort of specify what the variables are, what the parameters are, and then you can generate this complexity. It's not just a random mess. It is, in fact, something that is operating under some fairly constrained circumstances. Not a deterministic law, but under constraints. And the constraints should be specifiable, even if what you're specifying is something that's probabilistic. Okay? That's a very important thing to keep in mind if one wants to use any of this complexity. That's at the very least, you should adhere to this. Otherwise, you're just talking about complicated stuff you don't understand. Which, of course, is, you know, a lot of that in the world, for sure. But you don't need fancy physics to, you know, make that apparent to you. Okay? So it seems to me that there's at least, you know, there's at least a kind of threshold requirement that ought to be met if you're going to start talking this language. And you know, one could put other kinds of constraints as well, but the reason why I just introduced this very kind of minor constraint, you know, in a way of how you use the word complex, is because I think it immediately gets rid of a lot of stuff that people are calling complex these days. Where, in fact, what is striking people is, in fact, just the fact that this is kind of new and difficult to understand and kind of defies my prior expectations and defies certain kinds of simple models that I normally operate with. And that's just what's called complex. That's just complicated at this point, until you provide further analysis. Okay? So, you know, it seems to me, it's points like this where the positivistic instinct is not misplaced to make these kinds of distinctions clear, in your own mind at least. Okay? I'm not saying that you can't then go further if you go down the complex route and start to say, well, in fact, we can specify these variables, we can specify the constraints under which they operate. You know, we can talk about that, we can model this stuff in a way, and all the rest of it. I mean, I have no doubt that that can be done for certain things, but it doesn't follow that everything everybody's talking about under the word complex fits that category. Okay. And so you have to be clear. See, this is, again, what is the point of appropriating a scientific language? All right, so that's a very important one. And I say this with some experience, because in the sociological literature, I mean, this word is used with careless abandon by some of our most significant people, actually. And there's just no hookup to this original kind of scientific point. And if there's no hookup, it's just metaphysical gas, okay? Which impresses people but doesn't do anything. And, you know, I said earlier that one aspect of this is that very often the use of this scientific language causes people to kind of remind themselves that they didn't, you know, or maybe to learn for the first time that there are certain kinds of phenomena in social life that traditionally hadn't been discussed, and, you know, discussed under the normal social categories, but there was some discussion, and it was all done actually without the benefit of complexity theory. Okay, so we talk about things like unintended consequences a lot in social science. You know, the fact that, you know, people who are inside a system don't quite know all the consequences of what's going to happen, and things end up turning in ways that they don't anticipate and all the rest of it. Okay, this is in fact something that's very well known. It's very well known since the 18th century, at least. And in fact, this is what the so-called invisible hand of capitalism came from. This. And in fact, you know, for those of you who have a kind of taste for the sociology of knowledge, that is to say, a kind of sociological understanding of why certain kinds of ideas appear so popular and attractive today, I think that this is not an accidental connection, right? That there's a sense in which part of what's being rediscovered by social scientists in sort of harking to this complexity discourse is this kind of 18th century sensibility that talked about society's natural state is of a self-organizing, spontaneously self-organizing order. This is something you find in the 18th century with Adam Smith, with David Hume, Adam Ferguson, all of these people from the so-called Scottish Enlightenment. Okay. And there, you get this kind of image already there. It seems to me that is kind of, and the fact that we're now living in a period where people are quite disappointed, for example, with planned state-based control, top-down control, where, as it were, you know, you imagine some central planner operating with some laws of society, imposing them on people, and that that will then rectify all the ills of society. People have sort of believed that this has been a failure, that this has led to all kinds of negative unintended consequences, because there's been presumed too much kind of top-down intelligence and not enough room left for sort of spontaneously self-organizing things to happen. And see, people have that political intuition is very alive today. And so under those circumstances, right, something like complexity starts to look like a very attractive kind of alternative model of what social life is about. So when you look at this, I mentioned earlier this commission that Wallerstein ran about the future of the social sciences, right, he makes this point very explicit, namely that our normal conceptions of society are very closely tied to the nation state, which often, you know, especially if you think about a nation state as being closed under a written constitution. I mean, this doesn't apply to this country, but in the modern states, right, typically you've got a constitution which looks like the laws of the country, almost like the laws of physics. And it's quite clear, like let's say in the American case, which turns out to be kind of a benchmark for a lot of written constitutions, that connection was very deliberate in the minds of the founding fathers. They were very impressed by the whole Newtonian thing, to be sure. Right? And the whole idea was to get various forces in counterbalance with each other, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And if you look at the early justifications for the U.S. Constitution in the Federalist Papers, which was basically a bunch of newspaper articles that were written to justify the U.S. Constitution, the connections with Newton and saying we're having a kind of social order that is, you know, kind of perfectly governed by a set of the best possible minimal set of laws that will generate the most harmony. And that then became kind of a kind of blueprint for the way in which then other constitutions were established throughout the modern world. Okay, so the physics mongering was there as well. Okay, but of a different kind. But now you see the breakdown of the nation state, right? You see the failure of constitutions to be able to cope with all the various difficulties that come about and so forth. And then you say, well, maybe this is just not the way to think about society, right? That in a sense we're operating with the wrong physicalistic model. And of course, if one looks at the way in which physics has developed in the 20th century, right, and you see, as it were, not necessarily, I wouldn't say the falsification of Newtonianism, but the containment of Newtonianism. That Newtonianism is not a generalizable, infinitely generalizable worldview of physical reality, but just applies to a very restricted kind of space, and that, in fact, other kinds of principles are best used to understand the nature of reality. Well, under those circumstances, you might say, okay, by analogy, in the social world, maybe there's some role for nation states as these top-down planned things, but it's quite minimal. But for the most part, we want to understand society through these kind of self-organizing mechanisms and forces, which, you know, complexity theory seems to be drawing our attention to. Okay? So from a sociology of knowledge standpoint, there does seem to be a kind of what we sometimes call in sociology an elective affinity between this particular scientific theory, right, and this kind of ideology that seems to be quite pervasive in our culture these days. Okay, so it's not by accident that we're having this kind of conference in this, you know, in this era, right, as opposed to some other era. Okay, but it seems to be, again, this is more reason for you to be kind of self-conscious and self-critical about what exactly are you getting out of this. Because is this just turning out to be another way of reinforcing prejudice you already have? Right? Because if you're not really using much of the science of complexity, you're not really using much of the mathematics, but what rather you're seeing is kind of an image of political views you already hold in the natural science. You know, it's like you're seeing your own reflection there. It's not independent corroboration, and it's not clear exactly what the value added is from a strictly cognitive standpoint. Now, again, I think, you know, all of you will have to answer this question differently. I'm not trying to sort of condemn everybody here by any means and so forth. But it does seem to me that one needs to ask this question, especially given just the kind of interesting coincidence that, you know, complexity seems to be such a big idea in the kind of era in which we live, even though the phenomena that's being referred to is not one that just happened now. It's phenomena that's been known throughout history. This is not the first era that's complex. And in fact, from a social scientific standpoint, we don't have any straightforward ways of measuring degrees of complexity that we could say, hey, things are more complex now than they were 2 minutes ago or 2 years ago or 20 years ago. Right? Whatever measures people have tried to come up with, right, have been highly contested and often seen as very self-serving. Okay. Now, the additional point I want want to make about positivism in relation to all this is, as you know, positivism as a philosophical movement concerning science has always made a point of being studiously value-free, value-neutral. This is one of the things that positivism is associated with, right? And we want to make strict distinction between facts and the values, right? The science and the positive. We want to make these distinctions clear. Now, of course it is true that values are always entering into science, and no one denies this. But what the positivists were arguing, and I think, again, we need to sort of think about this in light of what I'm talking about here, is that we should take special efforts, as it were, to draw distinction. And this is one reason why the positivists were so keen on trying to sort of launder science of its legitimatory discourse. In other words, you know, what is this science really telling us, you know, once we get beyond the metaphors, once we get beyond the sort of sexy conceptual language that becomes easily popularized, what is it actually saying at a kind of cognitive level about the way the world works? Okay? And in a sense, this introduction of value neutrality is part of that process. Namely, you're sort of separating out, as it were, the evocative element, right, of the scientific language from, you know, the aspects that actually can help you understand things better than you understood them before. Okay? Now, this has a very important role in this context because, as far as I can see, people who talk about complexity tend to think it's a good thing. Or tend to think, you know, we should live with it. Or, you know, it's okay. Right? And in this respect, this is a very characteristic, you know, when one uses, you know, appeals to the natural sciences to try to understand or explain social life and do so in a very explicit kind of way. I mean, I would say the same thing applies when Darwinism is invoked, right? It is applied in a positive way, right? So to give a Darwinian explanation of something or to say that something is the way it is for Darwinian reasons is to legitimate in some form. It's not to say, oh no, we better stop it now because it's Darwinian. We could, of course, but the tendency is not to do that. The tendency is that beyond the just pure explanatory value that these natural science concepts are supposed to provide on social life, there's also a kind of normative thing going on, right? Where in a sense, you know, this is kind of the way the world is, in a sense, this is the way it's meant to be. And so it is interesting that when one does invoke complexity, it tends to be in a positive way. So that the whole idea of reducing complexity, this is something positives were always quite interested in, actually, right? People don't talk this way anymore. I've been looking at a lot of the recent literature on this topic. You know, back in the old days, complexity was something people wanted to reduce. Nobody wants to reduce complexity anymore. People want to kind of celebrate, right? Or recognize it, or something like this, right? And I think this, you know, this raises some issues here, right? Now, there may, of course, be reasons why one wants to, you know, celebrate or endorse or value particular examples of complex phenomena that one's identified. But that should have to do with the way the phenomena functions in the context you're talking about it. It shouldn't have to do with the mere fact that they're complex, right? Or that represents some working out of complex, you know, of a complexity equation or something. Okay? Just like with regard to Darwinism, you know, it may be that some phenomena that can be explained very well by Darwinian means, you know, is one that we happen to like. We like this phenomena that we can easily explain by a Darwinian process. But it's not because, we shouldn't like it because it can be explained by a Darwinian process. Rather, we should like it because of what it does for us or for the people to whom this process applies, right? So the point here then being that the fact that one's appropriating certain kinds of scientific theories for explanatory purposes, even if they are appropriate for explaining the phenomena, so let's assume complexity theory can explain something. Assume Darwinism can explain what you're doing, right? It doesn't follow necessarily that they have to be endorsed, right? It may be, yes, I can explain it this way, but now we got to do something about it. We have to change it. Now, those of you who know something about the history of Darwinism will know that this has been a long-standing issue, and that the history of Darwinism isn't simply a history of people rolling over and saying, well, if you buy a Darwinian explanation, therefore you have to kind of endorse these processes that Darwin is, you know, that natural selection can explain. No, there have been a lot of attempts to try to, in a way, reverse or control or contain and all the rest of it. And this applies for any kind of phenomena that is explained by natural scientific means. Okay? So there's, and this is what I mean by the fact-value distinction coming in. There's a sense in which one is driving a wedge, drawing a distinction between what one is doing as a scientist in explaining things and what one thinks about what one's done, you know, about the nature of the phenomena. So you can explain something by certain natural scientific means, but then you might say, we need to change it. It's not good. And so that one needs to think with regard to complexity, right, that to demonstrate something is a complex phenomena, and that it fits, even if it fits certain kinds of equations, right, it doesn't follow that it's good. It doesn't follow that it's in some way something we have to keep on endorsing or the rest of it. Okay, that is a separate kind of question. Now, I think the reason why this point isn't made very obvious most of the time is because complexity, right, as part of the, you know, part of the neoliberalism thing I was alluding to earlier with the decline of the nation state, along with it, of course, that goes along, runs right alongside of it at the cultural level is postmodernism. So all these things, neoliberalism, postmodernism, complexity, they're kind of all, you know, kind of parallel streams, you might say, of the times in which we live. One of the things that postmodernism has always been very much against is the idea that there can be some unifying story of how everything is, right? There's some master narrative, as it's often called. And this is, of course, very much connected with, you know, so the decline of master narratives is connected with the decline of the nation state, because the nation state, in a sense, is a site where master narratives often get told, right? When we talk about the history of Britain, or the history of, you know, some country, and one then talks about how all these people are, in fact, moving in a certain kind of direction, you know, trying to realize a certain goal, whatever. Okay? And so the breakdown of all these things go together. And what I want to say about that is that it is true, right, that there's a sense in which we may have been operating with very simplified understandings of social life in the past, that we may, in fact, have been using inappropriate models. You know, we take models derived from one realm of social life and we try to understand everything about social life through them, so we kind of overgeneralize. All these things are true. No doubt about it, right? But it's not at all clear that the alternative is to somehow, as it were, radically reinvent your conceptual apparatus and jump on board with the funky science of the moment. Okay? That doesn't necessarily follow, right? Because what we could be talking about is something actually much more pedestrian. Right? Namely, as with all sciences, typically, one tends to start off with things one understands and then tries to push those models as far as they will go. And of course, there will be a point at which there will be a breakdown in certain phenomena that don't fit those models. But then one, you know, tries to come up with a more comprehensive model. In this respect, I'm very respectful of the scientific method. But I think a lot of people in social science sort of think what you conclude from that is that the whole idea of coming up with general models or general principles is no longer valid. Now that's interesting, right? Because of course, in the next breath, these very same people are now reaching for complexity theory. Right? So they're denying that the social sciences can actually come up with any kind of general, universal principles or laws or anything like that. But the next breath, they're legitimating this by coming up with something that they believe, in fact, is pretty general and universal and doesn't just cover social life, but covers everything. Complexity. You see, this is this is the kind of thing, you know, the positivists would drive you crazy, right? Because there's a sense in which there is a sense in which you sort of forsake social science and then just turn to natural science as a kind of default fatalistic position. Okay? And this is not rational. Again, this is not to invalidate uses or appropriations of complexity theory, but again, you have to think about what it is you're doing exactly and why exactly are you doing it. All right. I realize that, you know, we live in times where people have to be chasing buzzwords all the time in order to get funded. So there's a sense in which a lot of people kind of get into this kind of language because they realize this is the language of the moment, and I'm kind of doing stuff that in some way, if I massage it correctly, you know, do a little linguistic massaging, I can kind of make it look like I'm talking about complex stuff, okay? And I understand that that's kind of what people need to do to get by. And I don't mean to sound cynical about this, because in a sense, that's part of the sociology of knowledge of this situation, right? The need to legitimate what you're doing, all right? But I think one always, there has to be a point where, you know, you kind of check yourself on this and think, do I really need this? And why do I need it? I might need it, you know, for a purely instrumental reason, like I need to get a grant and I need to impress people of a certain kind. But is it really explaining anything from a cognitive standpoint? And that's a separate kind of issue. I think, first of all, it's getting very hot in here. I don't know about you, but yeah, let's open the door. And why don't we open it for some discussion now? Yeah.
Popular
book actually reinvents a lot of this classical sociology that's already there in Comte and Durkheim and people like that. You know, kind of the population side of it, the interacting variable side of it, that we as sociologists tend to marginalize these days. He reinvents it and then slaps on all this new mathematics. And this book, you know, makes for a very sexy read. And it's a competent book. But the thing that the audacity of the guy is to say, social scientists, you know, these are social scientists aren't doing this. Well, they were, in fact, doing it 100 or so years ago. And the problem is that, you know, some members of the field disowned it, unfortunately. But to say that somehow we now need physics and chemistry to help us back on the chosen path is a bit outrageous. Yes, he does. Never happen in Warwick, would it?
Actually, happens all the time.
it's just horrifying. It's that kind of sort of misappropriation that, when in fact, if we go back and read the original work of these great, the 10 or so of the great physicists of the last century who discovered relativity, and quantum mechanics, Schrodinger, Heisenberg, Einstein, Bohr, Planck, they were all, first of all, not in the pejorative. Deeply metaphysical, because
quasi, but let's see what happens in my endorsement fully, because that probably motivates your question.
Well, positivism, Niels Bohr, Heisenberg, and so on, they've been accused of being anti-realist and positivist. This is my own research.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they were partly, in a qualified sense, sort of, but really not really anti-realist. But in this one certain sense, which I won't mention. But they did endorse the positivist quest for clarity.
Yeah.
Get rid of the silliness. And stop talking about this shit. Let's be clear. Use clear language.
Yeah.
But then they said, but the problem is that Bohr had said the taboo against metaphysics would prevent or ban our understanding of quantum theory because we don't know what we're talking about yet. Heisenberg ended up saying that positivism, that who could conceive of a more pointless philosophy, because what we can say with absolute clarity amounts to nothing but mere tautology. The search for total x equals x tells us nothing. That's absolutely clear, but it doesn't tell us anything. It would be the end of science. So that's why I said a qualified positivism to get rid of rubbish and strive for this clarity. But if we took it too seriously, then all we can make statement of empirical fact.
Okay,
there's no fact without like a theory which presupposes how you're seeing the world, and that theory is always going to rest on unproven assumptions.
Yeah, I see your point. There are two points to be made here. First is, on this business of positivism as a philosophy of science, I think the appropriate response it would be to say that let's say we've got Einstein's theory of relativity, and let's say in the whole it consists of certain equations that we can use to explain and predict physical phenomena, but it also includes kind of a conceptual apparatus about how one thinks about what's going on and what its implications might be at a more general sort of level. The positivists would say that the cognitive content, that is, at the end, what really makes it science, is the stuff that follows from the equation. However, what enables a scientist to pursue the program, you know, what motivates you, what gives you a kind of an imagination for what it's like to be in a relativistic universe where you continue to try to set up new experiments and test the theory further, right? That may require, in fact, bringing in all of this kind of metaphysical, metaphorical even stuff. But the positivists would make a very clear distinction between those two things. Right, so as it were, you're not confusing in your own mind or in your public's mind, right, what is kind of the thing that's animating me to do more research versus the stuff I've already shown, which you can accept as true, or at least, verify for current purposes.
I can't jump on it, but you're right, just quickly, because if you get David Deutsch talking about the many worlds theory,
mm-hmm.
as if it were pure empirical science.
Yeah.
And it is metaphysics. It is, it's Leibniz. It's metaphysics.
Yeah.
Or you get Tipler, Frank Tipler saying we're going to be resurrected in virtual reality, and he's saying that theology reduces to physics, and it's all hard science.
Yeah, yeah. That's the thing the positivists would be.
When it's pure metaphysics, and I'm saying, and that's when the positivists would be correct to say, no, it's not pure science.
That's right.
The only problem with the positivists, one of the main problems was, to say that the scientific knowledge, and they did say this, is the only knowledge. Russell has said the only path to knowledge is through the scientific method.
Yeah, but I think if you take this sympathetically, I think what they mean is that, but scientific knowledge isn't necessarily restricted to what scientific disciplines do. So in other words, what we're talking about when we say scientific knowledge isn't just the stuff that comes from scientists, but the stuff that meets certain standards of testability, right? Which in a way science stands for ideologically, right? So scientists say, look, we stand by this. But of course, if you look at the history of science, many of these theories that end up becoming well-confirmed and, verified and all the rest of it, started off from religion, from all kinds of other domains, right? So there's a sense in which I don't think the positivists would deny that history. It's not like they're denying that history, but rather it's, at the end of the day, where is the cognitive component here? You see? I think that's, one thing you have to keep in mind here is that especially if you talk about 20th century forms of positivism, the so-called logical positivism, right, they are writing in a very particular context that I think is very important, you know, for our own time as an analog. They're writing in the 1920s, okay, where there's a tendency, just generally in Weimar, Germany, and so forth, to just hype everything, right, where there's a kind of generally relativistic climate, people are making all kinds of worldview claims. This is a period where you get a lot of New Age medicine, you get the state funding for astrology for the first time, okay, again, under a kind of multicultural, kind of postmodern thing, actually. If you look at what's going on in Weimar, it's the first constitutional democracy in Germany, and, you know, as often happens for, you know, for a country that under, you know, so many years have been authoritarian, there's all these thousand flowers blooming, people making all kinds of claims and getting public funding for it, okay? It's just wild. At the same time, you got to, on the back of that, the official scientific community had supported Germany during World War I, which of course they lost, and so they were mildly demonized. So there was a tendency to be distrustful of the kind of standard academic physical sciences and to kind of open your mind toward all these other metaphysical kind of speculations. And so it's in that context where all these revolutions in quantum mechanics is happening. And this is where the positivists start to get concerned, right? Because you can easily see how quantum mechanics, with an indeterminist view, you know, of subatomic reality, right, could lead people to think of all kinds of weird things. Yeah, and so they were saying, whoa, right, we have to somehow put some kinds of constraints on this, okay? Because the issue does, see, for me, I think you see the real force, the real value of positivism isn't so much as a guide to how to do science, because I think what you were raising, in a sense, is the weak point of positivism, that you really couldn't use it to do science. It's not how you do science. You don't do science positivistically. But I think it's a very good kind of rubric for trying to put some checks on the public understanding and the public presentation of science. You know, in other words, as a way of disciplining both how scientists address the public and how the public receives what the scientists are saying. I think their positivism plays a very valuable role because it's always forcing you to separate in your mind, well, what is it I really know? What is it that's just kind of my own fantasy or what I'd like to see happen on the back of it? And of course, people may share your fantasy, right? And that may, in fact, motivate them to go into that form of research. So there's no doubt a metaphysics is a kind of motivating role in getting people to do certain kinds of science or support certain kinds of science. But the distinction has to be made clear. So in a sense, if you don't buy into the metaphysics, you shouldn't have to feel that you're somehow anti-scientific. You know, so like, for example, and I think where this issue really arises with a lot of pertinence today is with regard to Darwinism. Because Darwinism, right, obviously, you can explain lots of things about animal world and, you know, and about reproductive patterns and all this, but then, as you see with sociobiology and evolutionary psychology, there are all these attempts, especially in the popular literature, it's much stronger in the popular literature than in the scientific literature, to kind of, you know, bootstrap this up into an account of human beings, okay? And there it's very speculative. There is some research, but it's not nearly as strong as the proponents maintain. Now, you're an ordinary member of the public. Do you know how to sort this out in your own mind? I don't think so, because, you know, we don't really, you know, we sort of say, oh, this guy's a scientist, he holds a professorship at this university, he's writing this popular book. What he must be doing is kind of making it clear to me what the latest research shows, end of story. But no, he's doing more than that. He's, in fact, saying things in these texts that he couldn't get away with in a peer-reviewed journal article. Okay? And this is, where positivism becomes useful, because a positivist mentality would say, whoa, what exactly is the evidence for this? Has this really been tested? Or is this kind of like the draft of your next grant proposal, right? You know, that you want to then go and then do the research on the back of which we might show something. You see, this is the thing. This is where I think these problems do arise. And I think, the positivism does have something to say to this kind of situation that we live in today. Especially one, I might add, where the public is invited to have greater and greater say in what goes on in science. Right, because we live in a period now where, you know, the democratic participation in scientific decision making is more than ever, largely because of the way in which the biomedical science has become so central to science generally. And so it's at times like this that you really do need people to kind of reinvent positivism so they can make, you know, measured judgments about all this stuff.
Are there any further questions?
At one point, part of your unease that was a problem. It seemed to me to have a considerable liking
that I wonder why it is that people like the complex. The issue is, what's the explanation for endorsing the complex phenomena? Is it because it's complex, or is it because it serves some other kind of function that you approve of? Now, the latter is fine. The latter is fine. I'm not saying, you know, you can't like complex phenomena, but not merely because it's complex. Just like you can like phenomena that can be explained in Darwinian terms as having, you know, optimal reproductive success or something like this, but not merely for that reason. You see what I mean? You should have some other reason.
Yeah.
Right? So in other words, you don't want your normative judgment to just be piggybacking on the scientific explanation. But that doesn't mean you can't like it. That's the point I make. And that's the positivistic point, right? Where you keep those two things separate. Where what best explains your phenomena doesn't therefore entitle you to say, and it's good. It may be good, but it'll be good for a value reason, which has to do with the way in which you situate the phenomena, how you think of it with regard to other phenomena, and doesn't really have to trade on the fact that it's complex.
Positivism's claim to be value-free, it seems to me that some of the assumptions behind some of the things you've been saying, like an equating metaphysics with nonsense, betrays a value judgment.
Yeah. I mean, I said that in the talk, but as you can see in response to the question, right, metaphysics does have a role, of course, as a motivating force in encouraging people to pursue ideas, you know, beyond what's already known. Because you're absolutely right. If you just sort of just followed what was already verified, you'd never kind of move to the next level, right? You'd never kind of push forward the frontiers of knowledge. So metaphysics is very helpful in that regard. And there's no denial about that. But that motivating role is not a verifying role. And those two things have to be separated, right? What motivates you to do science and what shows your science is good are two separate things. You see? And the problem is that sometimes, right, the metaphysical language, by virtue of the way it's cast, can confuse the two. And like in the science popularizations, for example, right, where one suddenly thinks, you know, that human existence is completely governed by Darwinian laws. Right, which may be a good research program to pursue. Right, but it hasn't been verified yet. Right, and these two things need to be kind of separated. Right, so and see, metaphysics becomes gas when the two things are confused.
Maybe you should have one more question about the topic. Is there anyone?
Yeah. I hate to say this, but I think actually Philip Ball has some good examples in his book, in Critical Mass. But they tend to be things. First of all, they tend to be things where you can where populations are kind of the subject matter, right? And you're able to measure changes over length of time and space and so forth. So you need to have certain parameters in place, I think, that in social science we sometimes have, but sometimes don't have. So if you're studying, you know, kind of. If you're studying a small group, for example, you'd want a small group where there's a possibility for lots of different interactions and stuff like that. But they've got to be measurable at the end of the day, right? You need to actually be able to identify the parameters, right? And the problem is, of course, that so much of social science research these days is of a qualitative nature that eschews any kind of, you know, parametric kind of thinking. That it's just very hard to see how you could apply it. But of course, with the more quantitative stuff, you could do it. And Ball gives some decent examples. Yeah.
I just want to thank Steve for a really interesting.
Thank you.